Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Kind of stuck betwixt and between now, aren't we? The Senate voted yesterday. Today there is some grumbling about the underlying economic fundamentals. And the House doesn't vote until tomorrow. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, committed to helping Americans save on gas and become energy independent at publictransportation.org. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Thursday. It's the 2nd of October. Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis, continues today as we wait for the other shoe to drop. That would be the House of Representatives, of course. 218 votes are all that stands between Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and the $700 billion he says he needs to backstop the credit markets. We'll talk to a House Republican about how tomorrow might go. And then we're going to step back for a minute and talk economies, ours and the Europeans, and why a bailout bill is just the first step on a very long road. California Republican John Campbell sits on the House Financial Services Committee. He voted yes on the original proposal on Monday. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Kai.
We're going to get to tomorrow's vote in a second, but I want to back up to earlier this week and ask you what the heck happened on Monday that this bill failed?
This bill has been characterized in all media everywhere as a $700 billion bailout of Wall Street. It's not, and I'm happy to explain later if you want why I believe it's none of those things, but as a result, the public believes that's what it is, and they were calling offices and telling people in huge numbers, including my office, to vote against it. And then in the end, I think both the Democratic and Republican leadership didn't quite get it right, because they're not supposed to put a bill on the floor that they want to pass unless they know they have the votes to pass it.
As you know, the markets aren't doing so well today, Congressman. Do you think maybe Wall Street and the wider credit markets don't believe you guys are going to get it done tomorrow?
I actually don't think that's what's going on today. I actually think the markets probably have more confidence that it's going to pass tomorrow than I do right now. What I think you're seeing is, even if this bill passes and even if this bill works, the economy is bad. What the bill, if it works, will do is prevent calamity. I mean, it prevents a complete rapid meltdown. But even with the bill, and if it works, I think we're still likely to see an orderly drop into recession. And the after effects of this credit crunch that's going on, I mean, you're hearing about it everywhere, car loans being super expensive and drying up, loans for small businesses drying up, all those shocks are going to continue to be negative impacts on overall economic activity.
Well, let me what if this for you for a second here, Congressman. If all those bad things are going to happen, kind of whether this bill works or doesn't, what's the influence on lawmakers tomorrow to vote for the bill?
Well, because if we don't vote for it, these credit markets could melt down and accelerate to the point where people go to the bank and can't get their money out. You know, people can't get their money out of a money market fund. Those are all impacts that could be extremely, extremely negative if we do nothing. If we do pass it and it does work, things still won't be great, but we won't have that kind of calamity.
I don't want to get you in hot water with the party leadership here, Congressman, but you did say that they didn't get it quite right on Monday. What do they have to do, the Speaker and Congressman Boehner, to get enough votes tomorrow to get this thing to pass?
I think people, first of all, have to be convinced of how dire the need is and how severe the problem is. And if it doesn't pass and all these bad things that others are predicting happen, well, how's it going to be for you then? You know, when you go back home and then people say, hey, why didn't you do anything to prevent this from happening? So I think there's a little bit of that. And then I think there's a little more confidence that needs to be built up for some people that the $700 billion, it will not be spent. It will be invested in buying assets. And there's actually three different layers of security to make sure that the taxpayer gets all of it back and may, in fact, make a profit. And I think that's a misconception that's out there. The $700 billion will not be spent.
You feel good about this vote, you personally?
Nobody feels good about this vote. I mean, nobody wants to do this, again, Republican or Democrat. But I feel extremely confident. I'm not sure I've ever been as sure of many votes that I've made here is I am that the yes vote on this bill is the right vote, not one I love to make, but that it's the right vote and the best thing under the circumstances, not just for my constituents, I mean, for the country and arguably the world.
Representative John Campbell, Republican of California. Congressman, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai. Good to be with you.
Long before anybody votes tomorrow, the Bureau of Labor Statistics is going to chime in with a reminder of the real economy. That would be the one that most of the rest of us live in, not the one on Wall Street. Expectations for the September unemployment report are pretty low. So we asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to connect the dots between the current crisis and jobs down the road.
This credit crisis is already hurting consumers. Take these two women in downtown Washington.
It sucks. We don't even rent movies. That's how bad the economy is for us anyway.
I agree totally. I had to take my daughter out of private school, put her in a public school. The list is endless. I can go on and on and on, and there's nothing that I can do about it.
Until recently, Americans kept spending on a wave of easy credit, even while real incomes fell. But economist Stephen Fazzari at Washington University in St. Louis says that's over.
Consumption is starting to go down. In fact, durable consumption, consumption on big-ticket items like cars and appliances, has been falling since the beginning of the year.
The effects are rippling through the job market, hitting construction, automakers, and retail outlets.
I think the next wave is going to be when businesses are having a hard time borrowing to finance their payroll.
That means even more layoffs. If you want to peek into America's economic future, you might want to take a look at Rhode Island.
It's a small state, so we have a smaller scale, which means we have a lot of small businesses.
State labor official Laura Hart says those businesses often feel hard times first.
Rhode Island has, in other recessionary times, been one of the first states to enter a recession.
In the last 18 months, Rhode Island's unemployment rate doubled from a little over 4% to 8.5%. That's the second highest in the country. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Oil, gold, and stocks were all down today, and down big, too. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Federal Reserve's not scheduled to meet on interest rates for another couple of weeks yet. But the Wall Street Journal reported this morning that Mr. Bernanke and the gang are considering rate cuts as a way to ease the economic pain. Truth is, Bernanke's probably rubbing his lucky rabbit's foot and keeping his fingers crossed that by the time the Fed does meet, that would be on the 29th of this month, the worst of the credit crisis is just an unhappy memory. The European Central Bank didn't have the luxury of time. It met this morning, and despite worsening indicators over there, held its short-term rate steady. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is on the line from London. And Stephen, why didn't the ECB cut rates?
The bank says it's still worried about inflation. Inflation across the 15 member states of the Eurozone is running at 3.6%. That's well above the bank's target rate of 2%. And unlike the Fed, the ECB doesn't have a commitment to maintain growth. It's supposed just simply to maintain price stability. And that's what it's determined to do at all costs, to hold the line against inflation.
So things are rosy over there otherwise?
No, they certainly are not. This week alone, we had four big banks being bailed out and propped up by EU governments. There is a lot of worry about the possibility of a recession, not apparently in the ECB, but the governments certainly are. But the problem is, of course, the governments can't agree. I mean, we had this week the French government proposing a $400 billion Europe-wide bailout fund. But the Germans, who no doubt would be expected to fund a large part of it, said absolutely no. So there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of disarray. And EU governments will be meeting in Paris on Saturday to try and come up with a coherent plan.
Must be tricky to get 15 governments to agree over there. We're trying to get just the House and the Senate and the President to agree.
That's right. And it's particularly to get rapid agreement when you've got within the Eurozone 15 different countries. This, of course, has exposed the fundamental weakness in the single currency. The simple fact that you've got, not one country, but 15. You've got one interest rate for 15 different economies. And it's very possible to imagine a situation in which the citizens of one of those countries, which is in recession, get very angry about the high ECB interest rates and put a lot of pressure on their governments to pull out of the euro.
Let me ask you about currency for a second, Stephen, as long as we're on the topic. The dollar is doing swimmingly against the euro.
Yes, I think for that reason, because there is a lot of doubt. The dollar once again reasserting itself as the sort of safe haven currency. And there is a sort of gathering concern and growing anxiety about the euro. I mean, potentially, if this crisis continues, if it deepens, we could see the whole euro project destabilized. I mean, we could potentially see the euro blow up and the eurozone fall apart.
Let me ask you then the zeitgeist question. What's the fear factor over there? If you walk around London, are people talking about this a lot?
Well, I think there is fear, but there's also a kind of air of unreality. This hasn't really, this financial crisis hasn't really developed into a major economic crisis yet. People sense that something's coming, but it hasn't yet in a very big way. So I would say there's anxiety. People are pinching themselves and hoping for the best.
Stephen Beard at the Marketplace European Desk in London. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay, Kai.
The crisis in the financial markets has had all eyes turned toward Wall Street with the occasional long stare down at Washington, D.C. But it's not just Manhattan skyscrapers that are feeling the shockwaves. Over the past decade, a lot of banks and financial services companies have moved big chunks of their operations across the Hudson River. And now Jersey City is finding itself uncomfortably close to Wall Street's fault line. Sally Herships reports.
It's been a tough couple of weeks for Jeremiah Healy. He's Jersey City's mayor. When those Wall Street banks started to fail, he felt one thing.
Scared when the news first came out, because I started counting jobs, and I said, there's 3,400 jobs.
1,700 at Lehman Brothers, 1,500 at Merrill Lynch, 200 at AIG.
Now, maybe 15% of those employees actually live in the city, but whether they live here or not, they are coming here every morning at 8:30. They go out to lunch at 12:30. They leave at 5 o'clock. That's all foot traffic. So we have all of these small businesses that have evolved around that downtown area. All of those stand to be tremendously and negatively affected if those jobs went south.
The mood there is that everybody's worried about losing their jobs. It's a high emotional time. It is fear. It's driven by fear.
Joe Panapinto Jr. manages and develops real estate downtown. His office is high in one of the glittering buildings that have sprung up along the waterfront in the last decade. Panapinto says he smelled fear in the Jersey City air when the meltdown began, but he caught a whiff of opportunity, too.
It's not good news. It's never good news when financial and insurance industry is hit like this, but it's not necessarily as bad as everyone would think for Jersey City.
Panapinto's playing safe, hedging, if you like. He's put one project on hold, but he's going ahead with another development.
Well, we're real estate developers, so we always have to dream.
So there's going to be a new building?
Yes, even with the market the way it is.
Ground will be broken.
Exactly. I'll break it myself if I have to.
Panapinto has good reason to chuckle. The cost of doing business in Jersey City is low, especially compared to Manhattan. This crisis has brought prices down even further and lured buyers. Hazel Zolita is a commercial real estate broker. After the news broke about the Wall Street banks, she expected business to fall off. Instead, her phone exploded as investors piled on.
Owners are more willing to negotiate everything from the leases to what kind of prices they're going to be willing to sell for. So that's why people are out there. Smart business people and smart investors and really responsible home buyers are out there. You know, if it's priced reasonable, people will buy.
The shopping frenzy isn't confined to the real estate market. Crisis or no crisis, Jersey City's malls are packed, and residents are shopping up a storm. Like Hazel Zolita's clients, they're snapping up bargains as sellers cut prices to clear inventory. All this activity puts money in Jersey City's pockets, but Mayor Jeremiah Healy is still nervous. He knows how important Wall Street is to his community.
I do not root for any bad news for New York City. I view it not as a big brother, as a gargantuan brother, and our fates are inextricably entwined, for better or worse. We want New York to boom as they have forever, and we will then also boom.
Will $700 billion do it? New York hopes so. Across the river, Jersey City has its fingers crossed, too. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, getting back in the swing with sports sponsorship.
Who has deeper pockets, you know, and outreached pockets than golf with the financial institutions?
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial staggered 3.25% today, 348 points to finish at 10,482. The Nasdaq tumbled 4.5%, 92 points, closed at 1976. The S&P 500 plunged 4%, 46 points, ended the day at 1114. A barrel of crude oil slid below $94 a barrel. That drilled oil service stocks, which also weren't helped by Merrill Lynch's downgrade of the sector. Halliburton and Baker Hughes both siphoned off more than 9%. Schlumberger slipped more than 6%. Falling oil is, of course, possibly a sign of a slowing economy. Gold fell as the dollar rose. Railroad stocks veered off track on news of slowing factory orders. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.63%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, makers of ThinkPad and new IdeaPad notebook PCs, dedicating 1% of income, supporting entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Want to know what our hosts and reporters are experiencing as they cover America's financial crisis? You'll find their stories, insights, and observations at our website. Head to marketplace.org and look for the staff blog.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. The Labor Department releases the unemployment report for September. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice begins her trip to India and Kazakhstan. She'll discuss the newly approved U.S.-India nuclear trade deal. And on this day in 1949, the first African-American-owned and operated radio station, WERD, opened in Atlanta. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the big complaints about Henry Paulson's original rescue plan, and about the version that failed in the House on Monday, and about the version that's on its way to the House tomorrow, is that none of them does enough to help individuals with mortgages they can't afford anymore. Since the whole worldwide economic brouhaha we find ourselves in pretty much started with Americans not being able to make their mortgage payments, that's kind of a big deal. Yesterday, Washington launched a program called Hope for Homeowners. It's supposed to help mortgage holders who are in trouble. But Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith reports a wider solution might take more than just hope.
Lisa Monroney is 3 months behind on her mortgage payments. The sociology teacher from Greeley, Colorado, had been covering them with her home equity line of credit. Then the bank cut that off.
My value went way down because there's so many foreclosures in this area.
Monroney says her lender started working with her. It lowered her interest rates, which lowered her payments. That kind of private sector cooperation is exactly what the government is counting on to help stabilize the housing market, says Georgetown Law's Adam Levitin. But he says lenders aren't always willing to take a hit.
Unfortunately, servicers often find foreclosure more profitable for themselves than modification.
Levitin says modifying loans is expensive, but if a home goes into foreclosure, servicers can collect huge fees and get paid first when the home is sold. Levitin says that's the problem with the government's Hope for Homeowners plan. It won't offer real relief because it's voluntary for lenders. Levitin says Congress's bailout bill needs to help homeowners, not just stabilize financial markets. But Nick Ritsinas, director of Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies, says stabilizing financial markets will help homeowners.
In the long run, if we can stabilize our economy, that will stabilize the housing market.
But the clock is ticking, says Levitin.
We have a foreclosure machine that is grinding up 6,000 families a day.
Levitin says lawmakers should modify bankruptcy laws so homeowners could renegotiate mortgages when they filed for bankruptcy. He says that would help people make their payments and the financial markets could start humming again. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Here's another bit of housing fallout from the credit crisis. Rates on 30-year fixed mortgages have hit their highest levels in a month. Commentator and economist Chris Mayer says pushing that rate down ought to be front and center in cleaning up the market mess.
The news from the housing market is grim. Housing starts are at their lowest level since the early 1980s, and there are more vacant homes than at any time since the Census Bureau started keeping data in 1960. Millions of homeowners owe more on their mortgage than their house is worth. Foreclosures are accelerating. House prices continue to fall. Whether or not we eventually pass a bailout will have little direct effect on the housing market, which is dragging down our economy and crushing our financial institutions. But with its takeover of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the federal government is in a position to act. What should the first course of action be? We must bring down mortgage rates. Interest rates on 10-year U.S. Treasury rates fell by nearly 1.5% since the middle of 2006, but mortgage rates have fallen less than half that amount. Reducing mortgage rates another 0.75% or more could save homeowners billions a year in interest payments. Yet more must be done. To reduce the inventory of vacant housing units, as well as to encourage saving, the government can offer to match the down payments of new buyers up to some reasonable cap. And the government should allow existing borrowers to get out from under their current adjustable rate or subprime mortgages. How? By relaxing loan-to-value requirements on borrowers refinancing a non-prime loan. Homeowners could accrue additional equity in their home over time by making regular mortgage payments, while the government might receive a portion of the appreciation if house prices recover. Some would argue that subsidizing housing was what got us into this mess. But such arguments miss the fact that house prices have already fallen to the point where buying in most markets would be cheaper than renting, if only buyers could get reasonably priced credit. Two-thirds of Americans own their own home. Allowing a further collapse in house prices will help no one and threatens to continue the vicious cycle driving down the economy and destroying our banks. The credit crunch will not end until the housing market stabilizes.
Chris Mayer is professor of real estate, finance, and economics at Columbia University. You can send us your thoughts about real estate or finance or economics. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Baseball's postseason started last night. The NFL is going to be playing a full schedule this weekend. But I wanted to direct your attention to the Ladies Pro Golf Tour. It's in Half Moon Bay, California this week for its World Championship. More properly, it's the Samsung World Championship, which comes a week after the Navistar LPGA Classic and a week before the Long's Drugs Challenge. Diana Nyad's here to talk sports and what the crisis on Wall Street is doing to its corporate clients. Hey, Diana.
How are you, Kai?
I'm good. You know, it's all credit all the time, but that's why you're here, because it actually is affecting sports, too, isn't it?
You know, it is. I mean, the NBA has already announced they're just kicking off their season, not even yet, and they have announced they're going to cut back their workforce by about 6%. Major League Baseball, this World Series and the whole postseason is going to be popular. People want some good news. Yeah. They want something fun to watch. So I don't think the series will be hurt television ratings-wise, but 25% of the advertisers for Major League Baseball postseason are the financial companies, and so they've lost those.
Right.
So they've been sort of in a panic to get that beefed up, and I guess they're doing all right. But the sport that's really, you know, kind of in a quandary because of all this is golf. I mean, who has deeper pockets, you know, and outreached pockets than golf with the financial institutions?
Well, let's talk more about that, because obviously it's been a tricky year. They've had the Tiger Woods effect. He's out with a knee injury. And granted, you know, the Ryder Cup was a big win for this country. What about, though, those corporate sponsorships? Because that's really what that game is kind of all about.
You know, it is. I mean, 26 such institutions, credit card companies, brokerage houses, you know, have their names on PGA tournaments. And now three of the biggies. So we're talking about AIG, Wachovia, and Merrill Lynch. I mean, if the three of those are going to virtually disappear, they may be taken over, of course, and all those tournaments be safe. They are scrambling at the moment. On the other hand, I called a senior executive at Citigroup yesterday, and she said, Diana, do you really think that we are sitting in a big room in New York City in our glass tower right now talking about golf tournaments? Trust me. These men are sweating in their expensive Italian suits, and it's not over the Wachovia golf tournaments.
Let's go to the next year, though. What's it going to look like in 2009 as this whole credit thing washes through the economy?
I think that what we're really going to see is that sort of hospitality end of golf, which is very big. You know, yeah. You and I may watch like the final round on a Sunday, but that's not really where the huge money making takes place. It takes place earlier in the week when they have the big pro-am where some guy will pay $12,000 to get to play a round with Vijay Singh. Well, those are going to start going away. The tournament may still keep happening. The name of it may change, but all the big money making around it is going to really come down in a big way in 2009.
Let me ask you about the trickle down effect really quickly to the television broadcasts. A lot of those advertisers are banks and other companies who are having some problems as well.
Yeah, they are. I mean, there are certain tournaments like, you know, the FBR tournament in Phoenix, Scottsdale. It's hot, and those local businessmen are going to keep that propped up. But when you think that one third of all the PGA events, that the television dollars for one third of them are now coming from those financial institutions, all of a sudden, what are they going to turn to? Domestic cars? I think some sweating is going on at the moment.
The troubled business of sports with Diana Nyad. Thanks, Diana.
Guy, thank you.
Marketplace is supported by the American Public Transportation Association, helping America go green. You can calculate your carbon savings at publictransportation.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we go, the Justice Department, as we've told you, has been looking into possible criminal wrongdoing in the aftermath of the subprime mortgage mess. Auction rate securities have been a point of particular interest. And I don't know whether this item means lawyers are smarter than MBAs, but a senior Justice Department official said today he's not worried about how complicated all those high finance devices were. Never mind that the best minds on Wall Street can't figure out what those things are worth even today. The department says that complexity is not going to be a barrier to prosecution. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this 2nd of October. Today, the Dow fell 348 points, 3.25%. The Nasdaq dropped 92 points, 4.5%. The S&P 500 lost 46 points. That is 4%. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Fallout, our special coverage of the financial crisis, continues tomorrow, starting on the Marketplace Morning Report with Sweden's sad beginning turned happy ending.
We had a bank crisis, we had a currency crisis, we had liquidity crisis, all these kind of different crises at that time.
And next time on Marketplace, we'll learn more about the intoxicating world of collateralized debt obligations. You're not going to want to miss it, I promise you that. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.